Welcome to Let's Talk Learning Disabilities with Lori Peterson. Lori spends her days talking about dyslexia, dysgraphia, dyscalculia, and ADHD. She talks to students and adults who have had a lifetime of academic challenges. She's here to share their stories along with other insights with you. So let's talk learning disabilities.
Hey everybody, this is Lori and welcome back to Let's Talk Learning Disabilities. Today we are excited to be joined by Francesca Corbis and Melanie Roy from K. Altman Law, a nationally recognized law firm that helps students and families navigate special education, disability rights, and education advocacy. So thank you, ladies, for being here today.
Thank you.
I'm so excited. So we met at the Educational Consultant Conference that we were all at a couple weeks ago, and I was so happy to see you there. I'm a huge fan of advocacy. I feel like parents go through this process of special education or a learning disability, whether it's under 504, and there's so much information, and they just... I feel like they end up doing a lot of smiling and nodding. And so I feel like this advocacy piece is so very important. So if you guys don't mind, just first, do you mind just telling us, Melanie, I'll let you go first. Just tell us a little bit about you and sort of how you ended up where you are today.
Sure. So I was a special education teacher for many years. I loved what I was doing, but I found myself getting a little bit into trouble with admin because I would aggressively advocate for my students and really walk parents through their rights and their options if they agreed or disagreed with what we were doing. Sounds logical, right? That's what you would think we would do, but it costs money for the district when you have parents pushing back all of the time. So I realized that my calling really was supporting families and understanding this process. And I truly advocated the whole time since my undergrad ed degree. But I really fell in love with advocacy shortly after having my firstborn and pursued that more professionally from then on. All kinds of training. I love learning all things special ed law. But I really, my favorite part of this whole process is seeing parents go from overwhelmed and panicked, unable to make an informed decision, to calm, cool, and collected, and able to make decisions that are informed. And it's advocacy has been my path to that.
That's awesome. I love that. That's a huge piece. Francesca, tell us a little bit about you.
Yeah, so I'm the director of special education at K. Altman Law. I'm also the director of the Advocacy Circle, which is a platform I'll describe in a little bit. But my background, I have a law degree. I practice special education law. I really loved non-attorney advocacy because you can get the most done when you're not in the room causing friction, which unfortunately, just by reason of being an attorney, that happens. I also just kind of was an untraditional person who obtained a law degree. I wanted to assist children, child welfare, education, special education. And so I ended up really helping build this type of service into different entities. That's how I ended up at K. Altman Law. So my favorite part of my job, to be completely honest at this point, is supporting the advocates, supporting the parents. So I advocate for the advocates. I advocate for the attorneys. I basically make sure they can do their job so that they can help the parents, which was also my favorite part of doing that work as well. So at the Advocacy Circle, it's a separate entity. Do you want me to jump into that as well, Lori?
Yes, but first tell me a little bit about what all are the services that you guys provide, and then today we're just going to focus on the Advocacy Circle, but what else does your group provide?
So at K. Altman Law, we have three divisions. Melanie and I are in the Special Education Division. So with us are a number of advocates and attorneys. We operate from the advocacy level up. We always try to start at the most collaborative level. And if it needs to escalate, it's very strategic. It's slow as possible. And the goal is to make it as digestible, survivable, and collaborative as possible from the get-go. So that's our approach. So the advocates and attorneys work in that manner. When things need to get more conflictual, we obviously are ready to do that. So that's the Special Education Division, and we help families pre-K through 12 with regard to special education in every way. So any type of issue a student gets into, any type of diagnosis that impacts their learning, we help them navigate any part of that journey. The other two divisions we have are Student Defense, which they handle students who are K through 12 and then beyond in graduate, postgraduate, any type of program where they could be getting into any type of misconduct or Title IX, anything where they need to have that type of due process defense and procedural defense. That's what that team does. And then we have a traditional litigation division. Our firm was founded by Keith Altman. That's the K. Altman. And he is the backbone of litigation and the whole firm. But essentially, civil rights matters, disability-related matters are at the core of that division. But anything kind of related to individuals who are being discriminated against or who have some type of major, unique litigation need, we are open to handling. So we do everything from veterans benefits to disability rights to discrimination against individuals in all different types of workplaces. We actually also do name, image, and likeness cases as well. So students, okay. we assist students in having protections in any agreement they enter into as student athletes. So we have a vast spectrum of services we offer. We're a 50-person law firm, so not wow. huge. And a lot of the individuals there are at the advisor and advocate level, and they're supervised by attorneys. But we, again, throughout the firm, the goal is to start with collaboration and only escalate as needed. So that's us in a nutshell.
Right. So then through all of that, you guys developed the advocacy circle. So can you tell us a little bit about what led to it and what it is?
Yeah. So the advocacy circle was created by the special education team. One of the former advocates at the our firm in the special education division, Crystal Ash, her background is actually in curriculum development. So she is a big part of the content of this piece, of this platform. And it essentially it's a separate entity. And it has an AI tool that we have educated. It's closed loop, HIPAA compliant. People can put any and all documents they want reviewed and assessed, and they can get letters, communications, different things drafted. They can learn their legal rights. It's educated on all jurisdictions' state regulations. We continue to grow it. As of right now, it can now review evaluations in their entirety and give you suggestions, they can give you feedback, they can talk to you about how to advocate using it. And then we also have a full-blown curriculum. So this has been created by our team, so it educates in every aspect of special education. And then we also have these co-branded modules where we have other entities kind of provide a niche area of expertise that people can learn about. We have things like compensatory services, homeschooling, foster and adoption. We're growing it to Native American communities, military families, any type of community that has that extra layer of challenge sometimes in navigating different systems. We that is the goal of this entity. And then one of the best parts about it is that there's a community aspect. So we have Q&As, we have a monthly roundtable with the advocates. We have community forums, so different types of groups who want to connect. And at the core of this service is the fact that we found kind of what you were saying earlier to be the case with most people, which is that special education is draining and isolating. And you can know a lot, but still feel at a loss. You can feel like you don't have other people who are in your shoes. And particularly these communities that we have been, able to connect with that encounter all different types of complex needs that don't necessarily exist in every other community with special education. That's who this is for. And then at the end of the day, we're a law firm, so we charge fees. Our fees, they match kind of the standard practice across the country, but a lot of people can't necessarily access those fees. So this platform is $25 a month, and you get everything with it. And our goal is to make this as accessible as possible to everyone in the country and to have the advocates, at their disposal that we can through this tool. So we're very, 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 very excited about it.
That is amazing. You know, it's funny because I'll even have parents who are educators, special educators, but you walk into that meeting to talk about your child and there are six other people at the table there with an opinion that are usually all the same. They've already all met to decide where this was going. And even though you may understand the lingo and you may understand the processes, you feel very overwhelmed and very much like on an island by yourself with all of these people. And so in that moment, parents often do sign. They smile, they nod, they're like, okay, whatever. And then they leave and they don't even have any idea what just happened. It was like they blacked out. And so for them to have this, and you're exactly right. So many parents that we talk to, you know, even just to consult with an advocate, they get overwhelmed at the price and it is expensive. And I understand why. And a lot of families can't afford that. And for those that can, great. But for those that can't, then what?
I say this all the time. Every person on our team, every person at our firm has some type of connection to the disability community, has a deep passion for this work. And we always say if we could do this work for free, we would, because we all wish it wasn't necessary, but it is, and we all are committed to it. So this is the closest thing we can get to that, is making it as accessible as possible. So this is why we are as excited to do this as we are to do the work we do every day.
You know, that is amazing. And it's already got my brain, like, I'm like, ooh, how could we implement something like this? Because same, right? Like, I love what I do. If I could do this and do it for free for everybody, I would, but that's not realistic. But how can I provide something like this? I love that. I love that idea. Okay, so Melanie, being the advocate in-house or with us today, what are some of the biggest misconceptions that parents have when they start their IEP journey or their special education journey? What are some of the things that you see come up that parents have absolutely no idea that this was what was coming?
I think one of the biggest misconceptions we get from parents is that a medical diagnosis automatically means an educational diagnosis, and that isn't always the case. Now, whether things are implemented appropriately within the process, you know, you never know. But a lot of times parents go in assuming they're going to walk out with a plan because they have a specific diagnosis. And that just isn't always the case. So having an understanding.
Can you explain the difference really quick between the medical diagnosis and the educational? Because that is, you're exactly right.
So I think I'll do autism because that's a common one. And it's a category that you can qualify for an IEP or an individualized special education plan because you have autism. If you have a medical diagnosis of autism, that means you checked certain boxes from a medical provider through certain evaluations or observations or both, and you've received that diagnosis. You have autism. You can qualify educationally for autism without a medical diagnosis, or you cannot qualify for an IEP for autism despite having a medical diagnosis, because part of that process is it has to impact your access to the curriculum, and that's educational. So not just ABCs and 1-2-3s, but your behavior, your social emotional growth, your social skills, those things. And for some students on the spectrum, they're able to make progress in all of those areas without specifically designed instruction or specially designed instruction, with just accommodations, or sometimes without even needing accommodations. And that could be so frustrating for parents and create this block of contention because they feel like the school's lying to them, and they aren't, but also the school isn't walking them through the differences in a way that's understandable. And it's so emotional as a parent in that room. You know, we talk about having, you know, 6+ people in front of you who've all formed their own opinions, but also they're the authority. When you were a student, those people were in charge. So a lot of parents fall into that same role of they know what they're doing. They have my child's best interest in heart. And then they walk into that meeting feeling so heartbroken because that wasn't what they experienced, or they weren't sure. They don't know. They walk out and like you said, they feel like they blacked out. They don't know what just happened. And they read this piece of paper that's all in educational terms that some of them don't understand at all. And it just, it creates this big disconnect with parents feeling like the school is out to get them, you know, not having their child's best interest at heart. And unfortunately, we also see cases where that does happen too. So I think that's the biggest piece for me that I wish parents knew from the start. And how to get help when they don't understand, you know?
It's true too, though, even if they meet the educational, so let's go like with learning disability, right? If they meet the educational check boxes, you still need that second piece of what they call an educational need. And I think that's where parents get that feeling of the school doesn't want to help. They don't want to spend the money on my child. They don't, you know, they just don't want to help. Mm-hmm. And it's really written into the law that there has to be that educational need. But I feel like sometimes that educational need is somewhat subjective.
Absolutely.
It is. And a lot of educators think it just means ABCs, 1, 2, 3s, just the academic portion. If the student is making progress in the academic portion of the day, nothing else matters because they're making progress. And that's just not true. But that is how it's often interpreted. And because of that, that can create this disconnect. We have a student who can't make and maintain relationships, but is getting A's. Or we have a student who is not even attending school because their anxiety and school refusal is so significant, but the school's saying, but when they are here, they're fine and they get A's. So it's just, it really is that whole educational impact that it can be hard to document and to understand. And part of why we love the advocacy circle is it can help parents understand how to go about that process, what right. they need to look for, how they need to document it, and how to communicate it effectively to the school team.
I think the other thing that is frustrating that we see a lot of is when the school says they are doing fine academically because they have A's, right? They have A's, but how? How did they get those right. A's? How much support came along with that? I think when people just look at a report card, it doesn't tell the whole story. And so I don't feel like that's how you determine an educational need, but it's a lot how, like you said, it's a lot how a lot of schools do, but they don't and think about, well, they retook their test 3 times or whatever, you know?
Right.
And I'll argue that that's at the core of strong advocacy is that piece right there. That's what I see our advocates. That's where I see Melanie shine is teasing out what gaps there are, why there are such a disparity. There's such a disparity between what the parents are saying, what the school is saying, what the scores are and what's actually happening. That's at the core of it. And that it's a very strategic, sometimes slow process because you have to keep gathering the information. And I would also argue that, you know, when you asked Melanie about things parents don't know, it's that marathon mentality. You know, you're not going to get a quick fix. It's all about building information to use to support that disparity that we see.
How do you help parents? And it is a marathon, 100%. The problem with the marathon is that you still have a child that is having to go to school every day and struggle in some way, shape, or form. So how do you bridge that? How do you help the parent meet the needs of their child while we run this marathon?
One of the hardest conversations I have to have with parents is when they're providing outside supports to their student, and then their child is not qualifying for an IEP because they're making progress, and helping them understand that the school can take credit for any and all progress that is proven. So if you're paying out of pocket for a tutor and that tutor is why the student is making progress, the school isn't likely going to qualify you because they're making progress. Right. Path of least resistance. So we often have to counsel and coach parents on, as painful as it is, and I've lived it, as painful as it is to watch your child struggle and let them struggle so you can document it, it's a really important part of the current process. And the benefit is once you get through the marathon, having the appropriate supports and rebuilding. But not all parents are willing or understand the need for that struggle. And I understand. I think if all of us had a magic wand and we could fix that, we would. If all of us had the funds and the means to provide all private tutoring and just say, oh, well, school couldn't do it, but at least we're getting it, they would. But that doesn't meet the needs of every student, and that's not accessible to most families. So it's a lot of conversations. It's a lot of explaining the strategy, the reasoning behind the strategy, the data we're looking to gather, and helping them understand the success of not doing this. And the impact of not doing this. What does it look like? What are the long-term outcomes for the student that doesn't have this kind of setup?
So if you are going to let your, so let's say that I stop tutoring and I let my child sort of struggle, right? Mm-hmm. I guess as a parent, my first thought is if I'm having to run this marathon just to get support, what are the chances the support's going to be adequate? I would find that it would be very hard as a parent to have faith in the system if I'm already having to fight just to get the help.
100%. And we have those conversations. We have to explain the current process. And we also have to explain that once you obtain the support, there's some protections there that you don't have until you get there and you can't utilize until you get there. But also, we can build in some supports for that interim time. We can build in therapeutic supports. We can build in mentoring. We can build in things that are general education supports for the student while we're kind of building this case, so to speak, that they need specialized instruction. So it's not fully a, like, let them fail method, but also the opposite alternative we walk them through too of, okay, so let's say you decide it's not worth it to pull back tutoring. Well, now we're not going to have an IEP, and the slow rate of learning that we're currently seeing, what impact is that going to have lifelong? What impact is that going to have when they hit middle school, when they hit high school, on their self-esteem, on their self-worth, on their ability to maintain and make relationships, like all of these pieces. And usually parents are able to understand with time and a lot of coaching that they can do this and that it's worth it, but not all parents see that. And that's okay. You know, we're there to walk them through what their rights and their options are and to guide them on that strategy. But if that's not something they're willing to do, then that's okay. And we wish them the best and we hope for the best, and we kind of let them make that choice. But
of course, you have to.
It's a very difficult conversation for a lot of our families. And I think because a lot of us have lived it ourselves with our own children, we know that we're not just asking them to just like, oh, just give it 6 more weeks. We know that those 6 weeks are going to be some of the most painful that they've experienced or will ever experience with that child. And we can kind of guide them in what to expect, what to document, and why it's important. But it's a very frustrating part of the process for sure.
It is. Can you talk a little bit about how, you know, there are a lot of ways to be eligible for special education services. I think there are 11 categories-ish.
13.
Okay, I was close. And how that, the way that you get in does not determine or drive the services that you get. Because we have a lot of parents that are up against, that run up against that, where they get in the door, so to speak, but then the school tries to limit them on what they have access to. And I don't believe that's how the law is laid out.
Well, I'll say one thing. Sometimes there is not strong enough evaluation data to push for multiple disabilities or for a specific one. So parents will say, okay, we'll get on this one. But the IEP will address that disability, not the others. You can make the case for building more information to get that disability on there, but oftentimes they're disappointed because it's going to be minimal and it might not really actually impact their education.
It also really, truly, it's nuanced. It depends on the category. If we have a student with dyslexia and autism, and the school doesn't want to recognize the dyslexia, but wants to recognize the autism and build reading appropriate goals into the autism diagnosis, we could guide them towards that path as long as the dyslexia diagnosis is listed. If it's not a qualifying area, it's still listed. That is a positive option. Whereas if you go the other direction, you have a true child with autism and an SLD in reading, like dyslexia, and they only qualify for the SLD, that isn't necessarily going to give them access to sensory, social skills, speech, other areas of need that are consistent with their profile. So it really is nuanced. And I think that's what makes it so hard for parents, because they have this piece of paper that says, I have these two diagnoses, and they want the IEP to match, and understanding where they can collaborate and where they can meet in the middle and where they really shouldn't is so individualized and overwhelming.
And it should be individualized. And I think that's the piece that parents don't always understand, is that it really is based on their child's needs. And you don't find those out without a thorough evaluation and looking at all the social, emotional aspects too. Okay, really quick, can we talk a little about helping parents with goals and understanding the goals and making sure that the goals are measurable? But my biggest issue with goals these days are they personalized? Do they really, are they just from a drop-down menu in the area of math calculations? Or is it really what this child specifically needs? And are we really meeting their, I mean, I'm back from the olden days when we used to write on the 3-ply paper and I hand wrote every goal and then everyone got a copy from, you know, I pulled them apart. And so I had to, those came from my head, right? Like I didn't have a database to pull those from. And I feel like now it's a drop-down menu. And I don't know, have you seen less effectiveness with that? Or is it just making things more efficient?
Both, which sounds like a non-answer, but it is making things more efficient. And it is helping individuals who maybe don't have a background, a special educator who has a really solid foundation in math, but not reading, understand where to start.
Yeah.
I think the most important thing with a goal is it should always start with an understanding of the baseline. Where is the student right now? And where are we trying to get them to? And because of the drop-down method, sometimes the school doesn't know the baseline. And that sounds like, okay, whatever, as long as they're working on it. But if you don't know the baseline, it's really impossible to measure progress. And if there's no progress, then the IEP is not implementable. It's not working. It's not doing what it's supposed to do. So I think that's the biggest thing I work with parents on when they're looking at the goal, rather than understanding how it connects to the standards or entry points or all these other important pieces, is really, where is your student starting? And at the end of this goal, where do we expect them to be? So if a goal is written and it doesn't tell you where they've started, but it says that they're gonna learn how to read more, that is not a good goal. But if it lets you know they're currently reading around, their fluency is at this rate, and we expect them to get to this rate in accuracy by this timeline through these implementations, that's a solid goal. But it can get really nitty gritty. And I feel ego comes in a lot. As you mentioned, a lot of teachers are used to, they come up with the goal and the parents accept the goal. And they're seeing a lot more pushback with this drop-down menu and with AI, because parents can say, actually, this isn't measurable. And then the teacher's like, you shouldn't be writing this for me. This, I teach the student. I will tell you how I'll teach the student. So I think if you can bring it back to asking those clarifying questions of what baseline are we starting at the end of the goal, where are we going to be? The way it's written doesn't include those options. Can we make some tweaks so it does? Can be a really collaborative way to get a solid goal. But baseline, you have to know where you're starting and where you're aiming for. Otherwise, you can't write a goal.
How should parents be kept updated on the progress, right? Because we do these once a year, and you show up to your IEP meeting the next year and it's like, well, we met this goal. We met this goal. We didn't meet this goal. Is the parent kept abreast of that all year long as to what's going on? And should they be?
They should be. The IEP will dictate how frequently the parents are supposed to be able to have access to and receive progress updates. Usually it's at the same rate and intensity as their non-disabled peers, meaning if a typical student is getting a progress report and a report card every quarter, then the student with an IEP should get those, as well as a special education progress report with updates on the goal. We're seeing a big shift in the information in those progress reports, moving from data, which is, you know, the baseline, you know where you're aiming to, and this is how far we got, this is where the goalpost is, to they're making great progress. We're so proud of them. They're a delight to have in class. And that anecdotal information, which tells the parent nothing but makes them feel good. So They're appeased in the moment, and then long-term realize they have no idea what progress is being made. So we try as advocates to make sure that it's very clear in the IEP, the frequency, and also what is included in that documentation. Are we looking at the data, or are we looking at thoughts and feelings? Thoughts and feelings are wonderful and important, but they're just a small piece of what we need to know if a student's making progress. And I mean, it's different every state across the U.S., but some states do it better. Some states have it very clearly outlined. This is how frequently you're going to measure progress. This is how frequently we're going to report on progress. This is who's responsible. And some of those components are required everywhere, but some of them are not. And you have the right to push for those things to be added and included and specified. Because if it's not documented, it's just a plan that is not implementable.
Right. So you had mentioned AI earlier. So I want to circle back to the advocacy circle, because you had mentioned that the AI, there's an AI component to this, where parents can upload documents, request documents. How do you guys ensure that AI is giving the right information? Because I mean, AI is amazing. I am a humongous fan, but sometimes it spits out some weird stuff. So how do you make sure that it's how are you monitoring that?
So I can speak to this. So our AI tool, first of all, we have a team of brilliant people who have helped us develop it. That is not our skill set, developing an AI tool, but we have a very trustworthy, dedicated team that we work with multiple times a week to make sure that it is giving us the information that we need. We test it regularly. We ask users to give us any feedback if it's giving anything weird. So if, you know, the weirdest thing we might get is there's an unreadable PDF or something like that, and we can help manage that. But in terms of what it gives back, this tool cannot access anything other than what we've given it. So we have vetted every document that it reviews. We've vetted every site. It can only access it has certain websites that we've given it that, you know, state to state are reputable, accurate websites that give you the information you need. And then we test out accuracy regularly too. So it cannot access anything else. It's closed loop, which means that the only person who can see what's in your subscription, what's in your portal, is you. So we don't access, all of our policies and procedures are, we don't access, we can't look at anything in anyone's portal. So it's exceptionally safe. It's COPPA and HIPAA compliant. So this, the goal is to make people feel like it's both safe and, you know, educated enough for them to get what they need.
That's awesome. And do you find that parents have been able to take like a letter that they've used from there? And like, can you share maybe a success story or two that you've heard from parents that have been able to access this and it has helped them?
Sure. Yes. So across the country, every state has different levels of sophistication in how they offer certain things. In some states, there are worse practices. And in one state that one of our users came from, they wanted a 504 plan, which they should have, you know, after they're working with us, we encouraged them to move further than that and get an IEP. But they'd been for years trying to get in touch with the school, bringing in records, just not asking the school the right way, how to get moving with a 504 plan. And they put their information in the system. It generated a letter. They used that letter. The process started. They continued to put in what they were getting, and they got a 504 plan. Now they're on an IEP because it was not enough for them to be in a 504. The student was in high school, had made no progress. There was a lot of reasons why the student needed more than that. But that was one of our favorites because it was one of the early ones too. So we got that feedback immediately. And then, you know, like I said, we have families that work with the advocacy circle who come from communities that have different areas of challenge. And one is military families. Yeah. So district to district, when a family that travels regularly, moves regularly, has to move district to district, there are certain responsibilities of each military-based school district to transfer documents, to have a period of time where they transition the student in and they recognize what that student's IEP should be. And that didn't happen. So this parent was traveling with three children, didn't have their partner to be in support of. So they used the tool to generate communications to the school to make sure that school was following the process they needed to follow to transition that student into the school district. Yeah, because one of the major things that happens with these families too is that if you have a student who already struggles with transitions and then you're moving around and then you're alone doing that, it's another level of, you know, anxiety and challenge and isolation. So we loved hearing that story too.
Well, and those transitions, making those transitions as smooth as possible, getting them in, getting them their services and not having all the waiting and the thousands of meetings.
Right.
I think what I really like about this too is that just thinking about all the parents, you can go out and you can research so much of the law or get information from different websites, but it's doing it. It's putting it together.
Exactly.
That can be very overwhelming and like, how do I word this? And while they might have a template, that doesn't really fit my particular situation. So I still have to reword it somehow, but I don't really know how.
Yes.
And so this is amazing because they can just put in what's theirs, right? What is specific to their child and their situation, and they'll get the answers that they need.
I can't tell you how many times over the years we've seen families come to us who've utilized something like a ChatGPT, which is, you know, has its positives for sure. But keep in mind that model is trained on the whole internet. So you're valuing the Department of Ed's regulations and IDEA law at the same as a Reddit story from 2013 and a personal experience. And sometimes the recommendations parents were getting were just fully, like they were for a completely different state. You know, you've got a family in New Jersey who's getting told what the law is in California, and then they're feeling informed and they're making decisions, and it's completely different. I mean, IDEA is the same, but how it's implemented in the additional state regulations, that's very different. So I think what I love about the advocacy circle is it is tailored, not just the federal level, but the individual state level. So parents, once they input that information, are able to really get clear-cut clear-cut information on this is what should be happening.
Specific.
And this is how you can move forward. Instead of Googling it late night while panicking, while overwhelmed, saying, I think I'm supposed to ask for this evaluation, that is not something that's implementable.
And one of the coolest things, because I've heard said it so far, is that not only is this tool educated by Crystal, who is the assistant director of the Advocacy Circle, but our advocates. So they'll learn something unique about New Jersey and, New Jersey, this happens. Let's put that in the tool. So the family knows that, ask it this way. These districts usually do this. So it's like really, really nitty gritty, nuanced things that we actually come up against as advocates and have to maneuver around, understand, and hold in our brains. It's educated on that. So and the goal is to, when we start to get families from a lot of kind of condensed districts, bring it down to the district level and have the tool be able to be educated at the district level too, which will be huge.
I was just going to say that, like, you could even get it to district level, and that, because, you know, state to state is different, and sadly, so is district to district. And
for sure.
To know that in this district, we have to ask for it this way. And that's what works, you know, and that's always changing too, unfortunately. But yeah, the personalization piece is huge.
We tend to guide parents to include their handbook and policies for the district when they're uploading their information, because then it that becomes part of your file automatically.
I think for parents to just have somewhere that they could upload their procedural safeguards, which I used to joke that we had families that could probably wallpaper a small room with those, and just put it into plain English, because they give those to you before any time you meet, and you're supposed to have read them, and everyone assumes you've read them and that you understand them. And as a parent, it's like it might as well be written in German.
And it's so vague.
100%.
Sometimes it's so vague. We know that there's like 18 caveats to every single one of the procedural rights that parents have, but they don't. So they see one thing and they're like, okay. And one of the, you know, another thing about both the advocates at Cal, Kale, my mom, and TAC, the advocacy circle, is that
you guys are just right in there with special education and your acronyms. I love it.
Yeah, acronyms. We love acronyms. And also hate them, but love them at the same time. One of the pieces of the art that is advocacy, particularly with our team, is that the goal is not to cite law. You're not lawyers. You're not attorney advocates. You are educational experts. The goal is to make the user of the advocacy circle the same way. So they don't need to know the law. They don't need to know what they're citing. They just need a letter that insinuates, I understand my right here. It doesn't have to say, I'm citing X, Y, and Z. I'm citing the IDEA. It's just written in a way that is in and of itself exercising that parent's right. And that's kind of the art of advocacy, is gently saying, I think this is what's supposed to be happening here. So can we make that happen? As opposed to saying, you are required to do this, you know, because of XYZ law. You get a lot further with the, you know, just inherent exercising of your rights through how you communicate.
And you said through the advocacy circle, you guys do some roundtables and different activities that where the parents can meet, mm-hmm. and communicate between each other, right? Find that sort of common ground and know that someone else is, always feels so much better when you know someone else is having some of the same struggles, and you guys can yes. kind of commiserate, but also then come together for different topics and things.
Yes.
I love that.
Monthly. We have a monthly roundtable where all the advocates attend. We answer as many questions as possible. Then we kind of tease out further information that we want to talk about related to certain things that are asked. And then we have community forums that we monitor and assist with.
So it's almost like a Facebook for advocacy.
I want to note too, while we do the roundtable, which is more of like a live Q&A type back and forth, some parents have questions that maybe are not appropriate for that, right? They don't feel comfortable. So we also have that internal roundtable for our users, so they can reach out through a specific email and get answers that way as well. Still general questions. But
and really all of that is just $25 a month?
It sure is.
That is so awesome.
Yeah. Again, access. Melanie and I, we've known each other even from before working at both of these entities. I yanked her into KAL because she's amazing. We always talked about one of the biggest frustrations in this area is that information is really gatekept. There's a lot of, I know more, I can do better, as opposed to this is information people should just have. And if we could educate everyone in every circle, about this, that would be the dream. So this is why it's a very exciting project.
Yeah, that is amazing. Okay, so parents can find this through your website.
Yes.
And the process to sign up is right there. They can just put in their information. And this is all 50 states. This covers, there's no state left out. So anybody, and you guys serve
all 50 states,
clients across all 50 states. If they decide they want to hire you as an advocate for them outside of the advocacy circle, all 50 states.
Yes.
That is amazing. So I will make sure that a link to the website, a link to the advocacy circle is in the show notes so that they have that. And then listeners, if you guys have any questions specific, you always are welcome to email me at letstalklearningdisabilities@gmail.com. I will also have Melanie and Francesca's contact information in there with the advocacy circle in case you have specific questions regarding that as well. So thank you guys. We probably could talk for another hour.
Thank you.
Cause we could talk all things special education. Cause that's just what we do.
1,000%.
But this was awesome. Mm-hmm. And I am so excited. And you really do have my mind. Like how can I love the access part is key. And how can others implement something similar to allow that access so that parents can be better informed and feel better equipped to advocate for their kids.
Right. Yes.
I love it.
Shared mission.
Well, thank you guys so much. I appreciate y'all being here.
Yes. Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you, listeners. Have a great rest of your day. And again, if you have questions, letstalklearningdisabilities@gmail.com. Thanks, everybody.
Wonderful.
Bye.
Thank you so much for joining us today. In our show notes, you can find information about today's talk, as well as links to resources and other episodes. If you have questions about today's talk, have ideas for future episodes, or just want to stay connected, you can contact us through Diagnostic Learning Services on Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, and Instagram. So, let's keep talking learning disabilities. This podcast is sponsored by eDiagnostic Learning. You can find more information at www.ediagnosticlearning.com.